Okay, let's move ahead into our study for today. We're going to be launching into Revelation 20 and following. Although we were just a little pressed for time last week, so we might have to hark back to some things in chapter 11. But think of chapter 12 and following as our subject matter for today. As we follow the unfolding of the visions in this book, the Lamb took the scroll of destiny from the hand of the one sitting on the throne in heaven, and the Lamb began to break the seals, and so there ensued the opening of seven seals, unveiling God's plan for the end of history as we know it. And out of those seven seals, there came another heptad. Seven trumpets were blown, representing plagues, much like the plagues that came against Egypt, indicating a new exodus is taking place. God is bringing his people out from oppression once again and judging the wicked of the earth. And just before the trumpets came to their end at the end of chapter 11, there was this little vision that we looked at last week. We called it a vision about the visions, or you could just call it an explanatory vision. An angel came down out of heaven carrying a second scroll, a little scroll, announced that the first scroll, the great scroll, was about to reach its terminus. There's going to be no more time. In fact, the seven thunders were even taken out of the picture. John was told not to write them down so that things would move immediately to the terminus of God's plan. And John was given the second scroll and told to eat it, which he did. And it made his stomach bitter when he did. And then we suggested last week that there are about 13 verses there that make up the first part of chapter 11, telling a little story, that this probably is to be understood as a disclosure of the outline of the contents of the second scroll. After that, the seventh trumpet was blown, the big scroll came to its end. 11:19, then God's temple in heaven was opened. The Ark of his covenant was seen within his temple. So now the distinction between God's holy presence and this earth is taken away. People have direct access into the very holy presence of God himself. There were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. A verse that we've already noted to have a kind of formulaic character to it. That's an ending verse. John used it back in 8:5 to wrap up the seven seals, and now he's using it again to wrap up the seven trumpets, indicating again that this is what goes on in heaven, in the throne room of heaven. Constant flashes of lightning, noises, peals of thunder. So God's presence in heaven is blended with the earthly sphere, and this is the end of his purposes for this first creation. And that moves us then into chapter 12. Maybe just before we do move into chapter 12, though, we should review that outline that was given of the contents of the second scroll. So go back once more to chapter 11, and we'll just kind of run these events by to remind ourselves what was there. So first of all, there's an image of a temple. John is told, he's given a reed, and he's told to measure the sanctuary, but to leave out the outer court. We suggested there's a duality there. God is keeping the sanctuary, but he's letting the court be trampled by the nations. Suggested that the temple is not a future literal rebuilding of the Old Testament temple, but rather what John is doing is lifting out pictures, images, languages from the Old Testament, and he's replaying those images, though the underlying reality in the New Covenant period that he's probably talking about is the church. And then two witnesses immediately juxtaposed to that temple. Two witnesses are introduced into the picture. They're going to prophesy for a 3.5-year period. He calls it 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth, indicating that the message they have for the world is a somber message, one of impending judgment. They're clothed in sackcloth because they sense that it's going to go ill for the inhabitants of earth. They're also called two olive trees, two lampstands. That was the clue based on chapter 1 that suggested to us John is thinking of the church. But they're also described in terms of several of the Old Testament prophets. They do things like Elijah or like Moses. Their word, like the word of Jeremiah, is one that torments the people on earth. And then in verse 7, when those two prophets have finished their testimony, and again, the suggestion last week was that these two prophets are not to be understood as individual human beings, individual prophets, but they probably represent God's church. Why are there two of them then? Well, maybe because in the Old Testament, any time there was a trial and it was a capital case, somebody's life was at stake, the Old Testament indicates you're never to put someone to death on the basis of a single witness. It's got to be two or three. So there's a deliberate doubling of these witnesses representing the church, indicating it is a capital case for the world. The world's life is at stake in God's courtroom. I'm not going to take time to talk about every detail, where he gets the two olive trees from, Zechariah's prophecy, the two lampstands, blah, blah, blah. But in verse 7, when they have finished their testimony, in other words, when the church has borne its prophetic witness in the last days, the beast that ascends from the bottomless pit will make war upon them and conquer them and kill them. And so the whole world rejoices that they're dead, but God vindicates them by raising them from the dead and inviting them to come up to a cloud in heaven. Looking at those verses last week gave us an opportunity just to reflect a little bit on the kind of language, the nature of the language used in this book. Maybe we could just home in on verse 9, because this illustrates it again. We saw that in the passage as a whole, John tends to be taking images from the Old Testament and kind of piling them on top of one another. In a way that they, logically they don't fit, but because it's picture language, he can do this kind of thing. There's a really good example of that right in verse 8 itself. So it says, their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. So let's just work backwards through those indications. Where was Jesus crucified? Golgotha, which is a hill near what city? Okay, just outside of Jerusalem. So shall we identify this city in the story with the city of Jerusalem? Well, if you move back, the name of this city is also called Egypt. Well, Jerusalem is not in Egypt. The literal Jerusalem is in Israel. Egypt is another place. Moving back again, that city is also called Sodom, which is over kind of kind of in the plain by the Dead Sea, at least it was, while there was a city called Sodom. All of those names then, which represent different places, were told that this city that John has in mind is allegorically. That's how the RSV translates the word. In the original language, is pneumatiko, spiritually. This city is given those three names. But John has called it the great city. So let's put one more on the map. At the time when this book was written, probably in the late 90s of the first century, what was the great city of the world? Rome. Rome was the largest. It was the imperial city. That's where the emperor had his throne. Probably had something like 3.5 million people. It was the metropolis of the Mediterranean basin at that time. So the city John is talking about is Rome, but it's also Sodom, but it's also Egypt, but it's also Jerusalem. So, you know, how do you make sense of that? Well, what is he saying about Rome? If Rome is kind of the basic denotation here, and of course, Rome was not just an isolated place, it was kind of the model city. All the other cities of the Mediterranean had been conquered by Rome, and so they looked up to its power and its glory, and they did what they could, not only to suck up to the emperor, but also to imitate Roman ways, Roman customs, and so forth. And so in a sense, to talk about Rome is to talk about the entire empire and all of its cities, but Rome. To call Rome Sodom would mean, what do you think John has in mind? Why would he call Rome Sodom? Yeah, deep, deep sinfulness, wickedness in the sight of God. Why call it Egypt? Okay, Egypt was known for its idolatry, worship of animals in their statuary and in the paintings we find in the tombs and so forth. We find people worshiping idols there. They also, Egypt was also that nation that had oppressed the people of God. And then we come to Jerusalem crucifying Jesus. Well, you know, those are three things that John wants to suggest Roman society is doing to the people of God. And so the people of God need to be vindicated out of all of that. So just another note on the nature of the language here. Any points you'd like to raise or questions stemming from last week, and in particular from Revelation 11, 1 to 13. I want to move on, but I also want to pause long enough so that we feel at least somewhat comfortable as we proceed, that I've explained at least enough so that we can follow what the writer is doing. Oh, definitely human, yes. The two witnesses introduced in verse 3, they're certainly given a prophetic role, and they're treated as human beings throughout. You know, they get slain by the beast, their bodies lie in this great city, which is spiritually called Sodom, Egypt, and the place where their Lord was crucified. But God blows the breath of life into them. They stand up on their feet. You know, it all looks like... So I think it's a description of the church in its prophetic role in the last days, announcing God's judgment, seeking to call a hardened world back to the ways of God.
And their testimony, does it do any, do people come to Christ at this point yet?
Right. It looks as though the response of the world, rather, is to say it's Christmas time when the beast finally has slain them and let their bodies lie unburied. The world absolutely rejects the testimony of the church. It's a matter of the closing of the global heart against the ministry of the Word of God. Now, for plainer language describing all of that, you know, we could go back to a place like 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and following, where Paul reviews more or less the same schema of events, but the language he uses, it also is apocalyptic language, but I think it's a little bit more prosaic and plain. There aren't quite as many layered allusions to the Old Testament in Paul as there are in John. So 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, let no one deceive you in any way. That day, he's talking about our being assembled to meet Christ, kind of. That day isn't going to happen. It's not going to come unless the rebellion comes first. Apostasis, unless the great apostasy takes place first. And the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition, the Antichrist figure who sets himself against God and against all truth. So Paul speaks there of a great apostasy, kind of a global closing of hearts. Actually, I should have read a little further. And then further down, verse 8, after the mystery of lawlessness has been restrained for a while, the restrainer will be taken out of the way. That's in verse 7. Then the lawless one will be revealed. The Lord Jesus will slay him. But verse 9, his coming will be by the activity of Satan with all power and pretended signs and wonders, with all wicked deception for those who are to perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. That's probably what John is describing as the beast that comes up out of the abyss in Revelation chapter 11, verse 7. So same idea, just a different form of words to describe it. So does that help at all? Yeah? Okay, well, let's move into chapter 12. We'll have to refer back to 11, 1 to 13 a few times. But let's get into chapter 12. And now I want us always to see the big picture and not just the details. The details take on their full significance only when we see how all these visions fit together. So we're moving into a new set of visions. John has called it a second vision, a little scroll. He's prophesying again, as chapter 10 said. So the first prophecy, consisting of the seals and the trumpets, has come to its end, and now we're in, apparently, the little scroll. The next section, I'll just lay it on the table, comprises chapters 12, 13, 14, and just a little bit into 15. And let's look at the characters that are introduced. The first couple are right up there toward the front. So 12:1, a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child, and she cried out in her pangs of birth in anguish for delivery. So the first character John puts on the plate is this celestial woman about to give birth to a child. Then a second character moves into view. Another portent appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, 7 diadems upon his heads. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, that he might devour her child when she brought it forth. She brought forth a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. So right there in verse 5, this child of the woman is destined to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. There's a clear reference to Psalm 2, one of the messianic psalms. And he gets caught up to God into his throne. There's the ascension of Christ. We who live after that event can recognize this. And then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which to be nourished for 1,260 days. There's that interesting period of time again, the 3.5-year period. Last week we saw that if you assume a year of 360 days, kind of a rounded off year with nothing but 30-day months, then you get to this number of days in 3.5 years. Now we're going to skip over the subsequent events as we rush ahead, just to get an overview of the characters that make up and the main events that make up the little scroll. Over in chapter 13, and we're not going to look at this yet today, I don't think we'll have time, but I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, 10 diadems upon its horns, and a blasphemous name upon its head. So here's the beast, kind of a composite figure based on the vision in Daniel 7 that describes a leopard, a bear, a lion. Here they're all combined into one big figure. And he goes after the people of God. Then down in verse 11, I saw another beast which rose out of the earth. So the first one rises up out of the sea. The second beast rises up out of the earth. And it's very much like the first beast in many ways, but it seems to be the speaker. It's the mouthpiece. It spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence. Then yet another set of characters are introduced in 14:1. I looked, and lo, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, with him 144,000, who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. In the middle of chapter 14, we have another vision about the visions from verses 6 down to 13. This is one of these explanatory passages designed to help us follow the unfolding of the visions. But then in 14:14, there's a dual set of visions showing Christ judging the world. First, he appears on a white cloud and reaps the earth with a sickle. Then again, he's told in verses 17 and following to put in his sickle and reap the vintage of the earth, and the winepress of God is pressed. After which, in the first few verses of chapter 15, the saints in heaven break out praising God for the justice of his judgments. And so with that, this little section of the book comes to an end. This is the first half of the little scroll. And so we've seen the figures, the characters introduced, the heavenly woman, the dragon, the two beasts, and the Lamb. Skipping over then to one of the further visions later on in the book, in chapter 19, verse 11, begins probably the second to last major series of visions. I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, he who sat upon it, called Faithful and True. In righteousness he judges and makes war. And down in verse 14, with him are the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure. Over against them, after an angel invites the birds of heaven to come and gorge themselves, We see in verse 19 of chapter 19, the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who sits upon the horse and against his army. So what we sometimes call the Battle of Armageddon takes place. Then in chapter 20, an angel comes down from heaven and chains up the dragon, that ancient serpent, the devil and Satan, claps him in the pit for 1,000 years. And then finally in chapter 21, verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. I just want us to see then how the characters that are introduced in one order in the section where we are going to be reversed. A, B, C, D, D, C, B, A. This is a great, we call it a chiasm in literary study, based on the Greek letter chi, which makes a kind of X shape. This is a huge chiasm that defines those two sections of the book of Revelation as having to do with each other, as though the great heavenly combat winds up in the first half, and then it unwinds in the second half. Tension builds in our current section as John introduces one character after another, and we see the combat joined. And then resolution follows in the second half as it unwinds, and those same characters reverse themselves. This big chiasm was first, at least as far as I know, was first observed by a German commentator by the name of Gechta. I found a reference to that in another commentary that didn't give full documentation, so I can't say exactly what the year was or what the work was. But that was the name of the person who first noticed it, and others have seen it since. So let's just bear that in mind. John is introducing now a new story, different from that of the seals and the trumpets, with a new set of characters and a whole set of events unique to these two sections of the book. Maybe I'll just pause at this point. I don't want to move so quickly that we leave people in the dust. Go ahead.
Couldn't a heavenly woman actually be Mary on earth and giving her a child? And I mean, if the history of that is really condensed in Revelation, but if Mary is involved in angels or godly beings, carried her to Egypt for a period of time until Pharaoh was gone.
Okay, you're asking a question about the identity of this celestial woman in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And she's going to play a role throughout the rest of the chapter as well. Hold that question. We will try to identify her in a moment. Although, you know, if you follow this chiasm, that might suggest something about her identity. You know, that's one reason why I want us to see these big patterns in the book, because one part of the book often will shed light on another part of the book. So if that heavenly woman corresponds to the heavenly Jerusalem who comes down out of the sky in chapter 20, then it might include Mary, but it will be more than just Mary herself as an individual believer. I think we'll see that once we get into the details. But any other observations anybody would like to make about the big chiasm that defines the little scroll? Combat joined and combat resolved? I mean, help. I think it's helpful. At least it helps me to see these things so that one knows where one is in the book. Okay. Well, let's try to identify these characters then. So we're told about the celestial woman, verses 1 and 2, that she's clothed with the sun. She has the moon under her feet. On her head, a crown of 12 stars, and she gives birth to this baby, this male child, who very quickly gets caught up to God and to his throne. Go back with me to Genesis chapter 37. The book of Revelation is always alluding to the Old Testament, and so it is here. This is an allusion that I first saw through reading a commentary by John Walvoord. Genesis 37, where Joseph the dreamer has had a dream and he tells it to his brother. So Genesis 37, verse 9. After telling his first dream, we were all binding sheaves in the field. Everybody else's sheaf bowed down to mine. And his brothers didn't like that. They hated him when he told them that vision. But then he didn't learn. He dreamed another vision and told it to his brothers. Behold, I've dreamed another one. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" Well, Joseph at this stage in his life might have been a little more egotistical than he should have been, and he had some things to learn, and he did learn them in the course of the hardnesses that came his way in the next few years of his life. But for what it's worth, the sun is Jacob, and the moon is his wife, I believe Rebecca, right? No, not Rebecca. Rachel was the wife of Joseph. Jacob and Rachel, and then the 12 patriarchs of Israel, 11 of them are pictured in that dream. So if nothing else, this heavenly woman back in Revelation 12 seems to be tied somehow to that family, the defining family of the people of God, the ancestors of the Jewish people in the Old Testament. And it certainly is true down in verse 5 when the male child is born. Yes, he was a descendant of the nation of Israel. Jesus was born Jewish. What else can we learn about this woman? Well, we'll have to learn a little more about her from the story itself that's told as it follows. But skip down for now to verse 17. After the woman has been supernaturally protected in the wilderness by God, verse 17, the dragon waxed angry with the woman. He went off to make war. There's that combat motif introduced for the first time in chapter 12. To make war on the rest of her offspring, those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. So this is a woman who has offspring. One of her offspring, the outstanding offspring, is the male child who gets caught up to heaven, so that's Jesus. But she has other offspring too. They're described as people who keep the commandments of God. Well, that could be the Jewish people. Jews were known for their devotion to keeping Torah, at least the believing members of that nation. But then when it goes on to say that this her offspring also bear testimony to Jesus, this tells us that John is thinking of people who have come to recognize Jesus as Savior and Lord. So I'm going to suggest, not just on the basis of that identification, but also on the basis of the chiasm. If we skip ahead to Revelation 21 and read what it says about the holy city there, Revelation 21:2, this is in the new heaven and the new earth. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling of God is with human beings. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them. I'm going to suggest that the woman, the celestial woman, in Revelation 12, 1 and 2, probably represents the people of God as a whole. The people of God corporate. The people of God as a kind of ideal. Entity kept by God from all the ravages of history and persecution. As Jesus himself said in those famous words to Peter, on this rock I will build my church, and the powers, the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. There's the celestial woman. Now, it's true. Some Roman Catholic commentators have looked at this. These two verses in Revelation 12 are probably the ones that give rise in Roman Catholic Mariology to the idea that Mary is the Queen of Heaven. They see Mary here. But everything in the book of Revelation, the way the figure plays its role in the story that follows, will indicate that it's far more than just Mary. This is the entire people of God viewed as the bride and wife of God's Lamb, destined to be glorified finally as the new Jerusalem. After all, even in the Old Testament, Jerusalem is sometimes pictured using the figure of a woman as Yahweh's bride and wife, because he took Israel into covenant with himself out of all the other nations of the world, much like a marriage covenant. Everybody happy on verses 1 and 2? I don't want to be overconfident that people are just swallowing all of this, but well, that's another issue for another day, in a way. What is that restrainer back in 2 Thessalonians 2? Paul talks about a mystery of lawlessness that's already at work, as though the Antichrist is waiting in the wings, and he's pushing, and there's something holding him back. Without answering your question, without giving you a satisfying answer, let's just observe that the same sort of idea is also found in the book of Revelation. Say, for example, back in chapter 9, verse 14, when the sixth trumpet was blown, the instruction, the heavenly instruction was, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. So the four angels were released who had been held ready for the hour, day, month, and year. So it's the same picture of forces of destruction or forces of wickedness or godlessness kind of ready to spring as soon as restraint is removed. And we're not told in that text any more than we are by Paul exactly what it is that's doing that restraining, but there is, imposed by God, some kind of a restraint on this until the appropriate time rolls round. So we'll just leave that question partly answered, but not fully answered. Well, there will be more on it as we go forward. Well, let's read the rest of chapter 12 and make just a few comments in the time we have. Now, war arose in heaven. Here again, notice the combat motif, polemos in Greek. War arose, from which we get our word polemics. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. We didn't identify the dragon, did we? Going back to verse 3, let's just spend a few minutes on the dragon. So it's a great red dragon, has seven heads. Keep a finger in Revelation, but page your way back to Psalm 74. Verses 12 and following, God my King is from of old working salvation in the midst of the earth. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads, plural, of the dragons, plural, on the waters. You crushed the heads, plural, of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. So here it's describing God as a savior who triumphs over the chaos monster of Canaanite mythology. And sure enough, archaeologists digging around in the sands of Palestine have found I'm not clear now at the moment whether these are from the Ras Shamra tablets or from the tablets found at Ugarit, exactly which one it is, but there is an ancient Canaanite poem that actually describes a monster named Lotan, Leviathan in Hebrew, Lotan in Canaanite, same name with the same triliteral consonants in it, and describes Lotan as a seven-headed monster. So John and his readers would probably recognize an allusion to that chaos monster with the seven heads. There will be further interpretation of the seven heads of the beast when we get to Revelation chapter 17, but let's just hold off on that for now and let the reference to Psalm 74 suffice. There are also 10 horns on this beast, undoubtedly referring to Daniel chapter 7, where he saw a series of beasts, series of animals come up out of the sea. Where is it in Daniel 7, the reference to the 10 horns? Daniel 7, verse 7. After this, says the prophet Daniel, I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast. So he's already described the first three, the lion, the bear, and the leopard, representing a succession of empires that would oppress Israel, the people of God. The fourth beast is terrible and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And further down in Daniel 7, in verse 24, as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, another shall arise after them. So that's where the ten horns come from. Now, when John combines these two images, the seven heads of Lotan and the ten horns from Daniel 7, I don't think he intends this, once again, to comment on the nature of his symbolic language. I don't think John intends us to raise the scholastic question, how do the ten horns fit on the seven heads? Which of the heads have more than one horn? You know, that kind of question isn't what John is doing. He's going to different places in the Old Testament, pulling out images and superimposing them in order to give us a description of this dragon as powerful and fearsome and absolutely ranged against the purposes and people of God. It's a monstrous thing. And then verse 4, where we're told his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to earth. We just don't know. There are some commentators who think that's a reference to an actual kind of pretemporal event. You've probably heard the idea that God created the world. He created the angels in heaven. And everything was good. Genesis 1 says that everything God made was good. But how did the fall come about? Well, the devil must have departed from his initial innocence. And there is the idea that the demons were originally angels that God created, and the devil tempted them. And so is this a reference to that event, or shall we take it just as kind of a general picture that shows the dragon to be destructive of God's creation in whatever way he can get at it? We don't know for sure. You'll find commentators on both sides of that question. And so we probably just have to leave that as an open question, whether it's a particular event or a general description of the nature of the dragon. Anyway, we'll get a real firm identification of that dragon in a moment. So let's read on then in verse 7. War arose, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and his angels fought. So here we have two leading angelic figures, Michael, the protector of the people of God, the dragon, the attacker of the people of God. They each have an army of angels with them, but the dragon was defeated. There was no longer any place for them in heaven. One very significant thing comes out of those verses. As we understand the angelology of Scripture, the dragon is not the counterpart of God. The dragon is the counterpart of Michael. He's only an angel, and he's not even as powerful as Michael is. God has no rival. God is absolutely peerless. God is above the fray in every way. There's no way that the dragon can attack God. So he attacks Michael and his angels. That's where he can get at. And he's defeated. And then we get the description in verse 9. The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, Genesis 3. The serpent who came and tempted the first couple, who is called the devil and Satan. Devil in English goes back to the Greek word diabolos. We have it in an adjective like diabolical. Greek word there, diabolo, actually a courtroom term to bring a charge against someone, to smear someone's name in a legal sense. That's what the devil is. He's also called here Satan. There's a Hebrew word, Hebrew background, meaning an adversary. Again, a legal adversary, the person who takes you to court and tries to get you in trouble and bring you down before the judge. So devil and Satan are really kind of terms that overlap, the one being Greek, the other being Hebrew in background, but they have the same general meaning. He's the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. His angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God." Isn't that a wonderful verse? Now, this is as close as we find anywhere in the Johannine literature to Paul's idea of justification by faith. Because justification, too, for Paul, is a courtroom term. It's when God, as judge, brings down the gavel and says, "The person standing before me who has been charged is just." Charges dropped. That's the picture we have here. They have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Rejoice then, O heaven, and you that dwell in it. Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Here the 3.5-year period is called simply a short time. He doesn't have much time now to have his final fling. So he's going to do his worst. Another thing to observe then about this story is, when would you say this heavenly combat takes place? It's sandwiched between, what's the last thing that happened in the narrative before the heavenly war arose? Birth and ascension of Christ. So as soon as the man-child is enthroned in heaven, this battle gets joined. Looking at verse 10, now it says, "Now the salvation, the power, the kingdom of our God, the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. They've conquered him by the blood of the Lamb." So what's that referring to? It's referring to the salvific work of Christ. And so here's the big question. When does the 3.5-year period kick in? We're in it. We're in it. Go back again to Revelation chapter 1 and read again, in the light of this new information, the way John introduces himself to the churches. Revelation 1:9. "I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus." The tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance. This is what we're all in together, says John. Now, that's not to say that there won't be some kind of intensification, some kind of, we've been talking about a restraint that's removed. So that's also a part of the picture, but I just want us to see that this This 3.5 year period that John draws from, actually we haven't gone back to look at the allusion there. That's an allusion to Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's vision of the 70 weeks. This is the final little period of time in that whole 70-week period. It would appear that in John's way of looking at the unfolding of God's plan, the redemptive work of Christ and his enthronement in heaven kicks off that final tribulation period. Just put that in your pocket anyway. I don't expect everybody to swallow that whole today, because it might be quite different from what you've been exposed to in the past. And we're out of time, unfortunately, so we're going to have to cut it off at Revelation 12:12, but it's an easy place to remember where we are. So we'll see you next week.